Sunday, May the 11th.
Welcome to this Burlington Audio Podcast. We hope you will be encouraged and inspired in your faith as you listen to this message. We'd love to hear what you think. Please be in touch with us through the website. More information and many more podcasts are all at burlingtonbaptist.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
We are delighted to have some friends of ours with us this weekend, in fact all week, Rose and Norm Dick. Would you give them a Burlington welcome? That's as good as it gets for restrained British people. That's our euphoria gene coming right out there. That's it. If I get applause like that any time, I'm feeling like I'm really up there. I wanted to ask Norm a couple of questions while we were together, because Norm is one of these global leaders, finds himself in all kinds of interesting places where God is at work. And you might be familiar with the Quiet Revival report that's just come out from the Bible Society that gives us in the UK a little bit of hope that a tide is turning, that for the first time in a long time, churches are growing, particularly with young people and particularly with men. Look out, women, the men are on the march. So that's a little inkling of what's happening here. But as you go around the world, Norm, are you hope-filled about the church or pretty despairing?
Absolutely hope-filled. I mean, there are so many amazing things that God is doing in the church globally. We're Canadian and we're seeing it in the Canadian context. One of the things that I highlight regularly is that the world has come to us. Canada has a very open immigration policy, and so the world has come into the area around Toronto where we live, and we're seeing churches spring up, people coming to faith, people being invited into deeper relationship with Jesus, and it's just this awesome move of the Holy Spirit that's taking place, and it's revitalizing the legacy church that's there, and we're seeing new growth in those spaces as well. So really excited about that, and then you just extend that into the global space is just amazing.
So what do we need to learn as established legacy churches, to use that language? We've been around for 180-something years, so we're pretty established. Yeah. What do we need to learn in the light of what you see God doing around the world?
One of the key things that I'm seeing, just to back up a bit, we're in the area around Toronto, but my primary responsibility, I work in Ethiopia and Myanmar and in the Philippines. And in each of those places, all four of those spaces, the spaces that we're seeing the greatest growth begin with a really strong commitment to everyday discipleship. So that really strong rootedness in following Jesus in your everyday life, that this is a everyday commitment. It's one-on-one with another more mature believer who's just a day or two ahead of you, or a step or two ahead of you, and walking that journey together so that you're growing deeper in your faith. That those are the places where we're seeing the greatest hope. Those are the places where we're seeing the greatest growth in the move of the Spirit and the move of the church.
And just share with us, perhaps off the back of that, just a couple of stories where when you see it, you go, do you know what? That's the church. Yeah. That's what it's about. We're smashing it there.
I told Simon this morning it's going to be hard for me to stay with one story, but I think I have the one story that I want to share with you. You may have all heard of the recent earthquake in Myanmar. Incredibly devastating earthquake. Hit just to the west of Mandalay was the epicenter. And we had some church leaders working in that region. And I checked in with it was the earthquake took place Friday at about noon in Myanmar. By the early afternoon, I was in text conversation with a number of the pastors there. They reported something absolutely horrible, that 3 hours after the earthquake, if you know the situation in Myanmar, Myanmar is in the middle of a civil war. The Burmese government bombed the same city that was hit in the epicenter of the earthquake. And just layered on despair upon people who were actually clawing out survivors with their bare hands because there was no equipment. But in that space, the church has come alongside and said, Jesus calls us to be present with the least of these, with those who are in the depths of despair, in the worst possible situations. And what they've identified is that in their community, while they are a minority community themselves in a predominantly Buddhist nation, the church is a minority itself, and yet there is an even smaller minority, the Muslim community, who is being significantly oppressed by the Burmese Buddhist community. And so the church has come alongside the Muslim community and said, we will support you and help you actually rebuild your mosque that's been destroyed by the earthquake. And because of that, the church is seeing people look at them in a new light to say, what, like, who are you and why would you do this? What makes you decide to do this? And they keep responding, this is what Jesus calls us to. This is the life that Jesus calls us to. This is the witness that we have been living in our lives because this is what discipleship leads us to. It's an everyday experience. Even though these are some of the same people who would turn around the next day and persecute them, they have gone into their space and said, we will offer to help you rebuild, be restored, because we have the hope of Jesus.
That's beautiful. Norm, thank you ever so much. So good, the power of what Jesus does. And that's where we are in our series. We all need a little bit of hope. And what we're thinking about in this series called Hope-Filled Days are the days after the resurrection and before Pentecost, when Jesus shows up to various people in various situations. And we know that if Jesus is going to show up, there must be a characteristic of hope, because that's what the Bible invites us to long for. The psalmist who was down in the dumps, why so downcast, O my soul? Why am I so depressed, disillusioned, despairing? Why am I so disgruntled? And he says, put your trust in... Anyone read that psalm? Psalm 42? Why so downcast, O my soul? Put your trust in... in God, in God. And then you fast forward 1,000 years or so to the writer of the Hebrews, who says that we have a hope as an anchor for the soul that is firm and secure. Who needs a hope like that today? A hope that is firm and secure, an anchor for the soul. And the reason that that hope can be firm and secure is that it's got nothing to do with our circumstances and our present situation. Our hope is not in some kind of ideology or way of life. Our hope is not even in the things that go well for us. We get a good health report. We start a new relationship. We get something that we've been looking for. Or our hope is not even in the fact that Ipswich were in the Premiership. Too soon? Too soon. Way too soon, I think. Way insensitive. Insensitive. Too far. Too far, out of control. Our hope is in the character of God. So Paul would write, may the God of hope, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. So we would expect the risen Jesus, wouldn't we, to be the bringer of hope. And that's what we see. That's what we have been seeing. The risen Jesus brought hope to Mary in her grief, to the disciples in their fear, to the two on the road to Emmaus in their questions. Jesus brings to them hope. And today Jesus is the bringer of hope to Peter, who's crushed by his own failure. These stories, and that's the invitation of these Sundays, isn't it? These stories are our stories, because these experiences are our experiences. For those moments when we're grief-stricken. For those moments when the pain of rejection is all too real. Who hasn't been paralyzed by fear like they were? Who hasn't walked the road wrestling with question after question and finding no answers like those on the road to Emmaus? And who hasn't been like Peter, where we find him today? Having to face your own failure. You haven't measured up even to your own standard, let alone anybody else. The pain of the rejection of that, the rejection from others and the rejection of yourself, the acceptance of not being enough. Peter wanted to be everything, and in that moment, He was not what he wanted to be. The fear of being left behind. That moment when it's all too much and we resign ourselves with the words, I give up. Have you ever given up? When you've given up, ... So Peter says, when we meet him, do you know what? This sucks. I'm going to go fishing. I give up. I'm going to go back to what I used to do. This is pointless. Come on, lads, let's go fishing. At least we can fish. At least in this situation that is out of control, I'm choosing to take control of something. Let's go and fish. Honestly, feel the pain of that. Let's just do what we used to do because we can't believe that anything else is possible. Let's live as if it never happened. Only to discover that they couldn't even fish. They're up all night and they caught nothing. It's a familiar pain for a fisherman, isn't it? Familiar feeling. But that feeling of I might as well give up was all too familiar to those disciples. You remember how the story began, and we'll get there in a moment. You remember that every Jewish boy, and I'm afraid it was the boys, longed to be a disciple of a rabbi. They longed to reach that stage in life where they had been chosen by God, and that was demonstrated by a rabbi choosing them as one of his disciples with the words, come, follow me. The reason that they were fishermen and tax collectors and a whole host of other professions was that they hadn't made the grade. You see, if you were a carpenter in those days, choosing my trade deliberately, it was because you were rejected. You weren't good enough to be a rabbi. Because you were a fisherman, it was because you weren't good enough. So all of those trades, no one skipped off to be a carpenter or a fisherman. It was just what they had to do because they weren't good enough to do the real thing. Can you imagine the sense of rejection and failure and I might as well give up. I've just got to be a fisherman. And so here they are again. They're swimming in a sea of failure and rejection, and they've given up. Have you ever swam in that same sea? Have you ever given up praying that prayer? Have you ever given up believing anything will change? Have you ever given up that something could be different? Have you ever given up in trusting for a different, better future? And like Peter, we too go out into the night just to try and take control of something. Just to try and find, however broken, my old identity. Perhaps that's it. I'm just a fisherman. I should have stuck with that. Notice what happens when you've given up. You ready? I need a kind of response, otherwise this moment will just fall flat and then the whole thing will collapse, yeah? So I'm doing my bit, you need to do yours, or the whole thing will fall apart. You ready? Yeah. Oh, good, okay. When you've given up, Jesus comes looking for you. How about that? Oh, that was a kind of good old response. When you've given up, Jesus comes looking for you. There he is on the shore. It's always his initiative. It always begins with him. We think it's about us, but it's his story the whole while. And he comes looking for these guys and Peter in particular who had given up. And notice what happens so often for us. They didn't know that he was there. Imagine for a moment, in the place where you've given up, that Jesus has already come, but you haven't noticed that he's there. If you read, if you've got it open in front of you, you can see that John, the beloved disciple, kind of nudges Peter and says, I think it could be Jesus. Are you open to the possibility that Jesus could show up in the place where you've given up? That preaches, doesn't it? Are you open to that possibility? I say it tentatively and gingerly and carefully because that's a really painful question. In that place that hurts, where we've given up, where we feel the weight of it not coming together, our dreams not being fulfilled, it not working out the way we wanted it, in that place where we haven't been everything that we wanted to be, there you believe that Jesus could show up there, even today, in that place. And notice what happens next. Jesus reenacts Peter's original call. So dial back 2 or 3 years. Peter's just doing his thing as a fisherman, living in his, oh, I need to be a fisherman then, because I wasn't good enough to be part of God's thing, so I might as well just catch fish. And he's discovering the frustration of not even being able to do it. They've been out all night fishing. This is not this story. This is 2 or 3 years previous. He's out all night trying to fish, and they catch nothing. And then there's this guy who ever he thinks he is, dressed as if he knows nothing about fishing, i.e. Jesus, and he says, why don't you try on the other side? And they mock him at first. That's ridiculous. We're the experts here. Whatever else is going on out there, this fishing environment, this sea, I can control this. I know how the game works here. I'm in charge in this place. And yet Jesus says, try the other side. And in the midst of trying the other side, they catch all this fish. And we know that Peter is just overwhelmed by someone who had had dominion and authority in the area where he thought he was in charge. And he cries out to God in that moment, and Jesus invites him to follow him, and Peter's been following Jesus ever since. And so Jesus reenacts that story. Jesus takes Peter back to the place of his true identity, to the moment where he was truly called. When God reminds you who you are, pay attention. Pay attention. When God reminds you who you are, pay attention. And of course, Peter wasn't paying attention. He didn't even notice Jesus. And it took John, the beloved apostle, to nudge him in the side and say, I think that's Jesus, Peter. You better wake up and pay attention. And when Peter paid attention, what happens? He runs towards Jesus. He puts on his coat, which is kind of weird. We normally take things off when we get in the water. But notice, he put his coat on when he got in the water. You'll look at me really blank. It's in there. It's just one of those little eyewitness details that reminds us this is a real story. You normally take things off unless you're going to save someone, and then you've got to go home and get your pajamas. If you've done your bronze, silver, or gold, you only do that with your pajamas on, yeah? So if you feel someone in the river, go home, get your pajamas, then you can help. But he runs towards Jesus. So I'm inviting you for a moment to pay attention to where God might be getting your attention this morning. Suddenly Jesus is getting their attention by taking him back to his place of calling. And Jesus has got Peter's attention, and he's running through the water onto the beach and as fast as he can towards. And then he begins to sniff something. What can he smell? He can smell the charcoal fire. He can smell the charcoal. And where is he instantly taken when he smells the charcoal fire? His denial of Jesus. The only other place the charcoal fire is mentioned in the New Testament is where Peter denied Jesus. He's taken right back to the place of his excruciating failure. Smells do that, don't they? I decided, because I'm a great romantic, that I wanted a new aftershave that was the same aftershave that I wore at my wedding. Isn't that cute? It was going to be my gift. Birthday, Father's Day, can't remember. Father's Day, maybe. And I was pretty pumped up about this. I made a massive mistake. I took my kids shopping with me. That was a huge mistake. It's always a mistake. It was a particular escape. I didn't tell them that that's what was on my heart. And I put this aftershave on that I was almost certainly going to buy. And one of them said, you can't wear that. It stinks. I was in this blissful moment of getting married to my wife. And in came, I was taken right back. But I was the only one that went right back. Because that smell had for me a connection. Needless to say, I bought something else. He sniffs the charcoal fire and he's immediately taken back. And do you notice what happens? Read the story. Peter's running towards Jesus on the beach. And then the next thing it says about Peter, he doesn't say a word. He slinks back into the boat. Oops, Jesus, I think the other guys need some help with the nets. Notice what happens. I'll just go back to the boat. And he busies himself in the boat with the task, with the jobs. He does as much as he can to avoid it. And you could understand that, can't you? Who wants to sit round a charcoal fire with Jesus after that? And so he slinks back and he hides away. I don't know what changed. We don't know what changed. Maybe we can come up with our own thoughts and ideas. But what we do know is that he eventually came back to that charcoal fire. If we want to get close to Jesus, we'll have to face that issue. Whatever that issue is. We'll have to face that circumstance, that hurt, that rejection, that sin, that guilt, that failure, that shame. Jesus is there inviting him on the beach. But when Jesus invites us, it's always from an honest place. Jesus is not one to pretend it never happened, to hope it will go away. But from that honest place, Jesus invites Peter to come to the beach. When grace meets your worst moment, you can meet Jesus there. Think about that for a moment. Whatever happened in that boat as Peter was meddling with the nets and he could smell the charcoal and he was right back at that place of failure, and then there's Jesus. What's he going to do? It's a huge moment of decision, isn't it? Many of us find ourselves still in that boat meddling with the nets because we're not quite sure what to decide. Do you with me? Does that make sense? We want Jesus with all our heart, but we kind of don't because he's by that charcoal fire. I know I can't get too close to him without being honest about that, and I don't want to be honest about that, and I certainly don't want to make a scene about that in front of all these other guys. And so he plays in the boat for perhaps a little bit too long. He wasn't wondering how many hash browns there would be, or whether his egg would come with avocado. Cultural reference right there. Just to show I'm up to date. Peter was given a full welcome in the full knowledge of what had happened. Super important. That's how God deals with us. You can have the welcome of heaven. You can have the prodigal father run to you down the road with the full honesty of what has happened. You don't need to hide. Hiding's over. That's what Adam and Eve did. Remember that a few weeks back? They didn't hide the apple core. They hid themselves. The hiding's over. An invitation to come with all of it hanging out, with all of it wrong, with all of it messed up, in all our sense of failure, we can come. Whatever it is that you think is in the way, Jesus already knows. Whatever you think has already disqualified you, Peter had decided the only thing he could now do was to fish. He'd ruled himself out of God's plan and God's purpose. Whatever it is that causes you to do that if God's going to do something, he'll use somebody else. If God's going to change that situation, someone else will go and do it. If God wants to start something, he'll start that with someone else. Because we've disqualified ourselves 1,000 times. Peter's in that place. All I can do is fish. And yet God knows all about that. And he calls him back. And he says, come on. Come to this place of welcome, breakfast, a meal. The power of the meal in those environments was massive, wasn't it? This wasn't a quick Big Mac. This was like a welcome. Breathe that in for a moment. You can come as you are. You can come as you are. You can come as you are. And as I've said to you so many times, it seems appropriate just to say it again in this context, doesn't it? If you knew everything that there was to know about me, you wouldn't let me lead here. And if I knew everything there was to know about you, I wouldn't have let you in. Isn't that the truth? Kind of just all in this together, aren't we? Messed up and broken and hurting and wounded and failed and doubting and all the stuff. We're just kind of in it together, finding Jesus. And there's this kind of glorious moment then on the far side of the meal when grace meets your worst moment. And I bet Peter, all the way through his fish, was going, "Don't mention it, Jesus. Please don't mention it, Jesus. Shh. Please don't mention it, Jesus." And then on the far side of the meal, Jesus says to Peter, "Can I have a word? Can I have a word? Can we have a chat? Can we just talk something through for a moment?" And Jesus, the beautiful healer, restorer, redeemer, rescuer, unveils in that moment his beauty and his brilliance. And he says to Peter, "Do you love me? Do you love me?" Notice how grace sliced through the air like an arrow to the heart. Notice what Jesus doesn't go after. Jesus doesn't go after what we as Christians are usually obsessed about. The thing that Christians are obsessed about usually is behavior. "Peter, why did you do that? Peter, you must have known that was wrong. Peter, do you realize that you let Jesus down? Peter, we need declarers, not deniers. Peter, you've messed up. It was just a slave girl. How can you deny me to a slave girl? Peter, will you promise not to do that again? Peter, if I have you on my team, I need you to promise that you won't behave like that again." It's all about behavior if we're not careful. "Work hard, Peter, at being better." No, that's behavior management. That would have left Peter in utter bondage. What would have Peter left that day fearing the worst, that he'd make that mistake again? Fearing that he wouldn't be able to be all that he wanted to be. Feeling that he wasn't enough. Feeling that he'd never make the grade. No, Jesus goes after his heart. And when we mess up and we come back to God, it's our heart he wants. He's not interested in our behavior at that level. Our behavior gets fixed when our hearts get healed. Oh, that preaches. That's quite good. But that's the way it works. And so Jesus goes right after the gut. Open your heart. And it took three attempts. I know the three questions are about the three denials and all that. But understand how the dynamic works at a heart level. It took three attempts. And on the third attempt, Peter's heart was more open. And he said to Jesus, "This hurts. This hurts." Where did that pain come from? You see, Peter, it says, knew that Jesus knew. Ultimately, that pain came from Peter's heart. So this beautiful, wonderful healer, in conversation on a beach one day, knowing all that there is to know, opens up Peter's heart. And something incredible took place. Just like opening a festering wound gives it the time to heal, Jesus beautifully and gently and wonderfully opens up the wound in Peter's heart. And when your calling is reignited, get back in the game. Peter wasn't just cleansed, he was still called. Peter wasn't just cleansed, he was still called. And he gets back in the game, he gets back on the horse. And it's weird, in a way, how the story ends so abruptly. If you were writing a story, you might not have written it like that. But everybody knew the end. By the time they're reading this, they knew that Peter had done everything to live for Jesus, even as the verses say, die for him. This was an utterly transformed Peter because he'd met Jesus in his heart. There was heart healing and heart transformation, and it was an unbelievably different Peter. And so the writer just lets the story tell itself. Everybody knew what happened to Peter. Everybody knew what a great leader he'd become. Everybody knew how he'd pushed through the boundaries of Jew and Gentile. Everybody knew how he'd stood for Jesus against the authorities and the powers, not just a slave girl. Everybody knew how Peter, in the end, had said, "I'll die for you." And tradition has that he was crucified like Jesus, but he wanted to be, he didn't want to be, but he chose to be crucified upside down, not to be the same as Jesus in a way to honor him. Amazing end of the story. Sometimes there's the dot, dot, dots, and everybody would have filled that in and knew that on that beach that day, something utterly incredible had happened. Because Peter, who thought he'd lost everything, had gained the whole world. Where have you given up? Where have you disqualified yourself? Where are you fishing in a sea of shame and regret? Should we be quiet for a moment? There you open up a little bit of your heart. I know sometimes it's painful. To be honest, usually it's painful. And as Jesus comes to us and asks us these questions, maybe we feel like, Peter, it hurts. It hurts. This is not to condemn us. This is to bring to us a freedom. This is to bring to us a healing. This is to help us recapture our true identity. We're going to sing in a moment, "Open the Eyes of My Heart." Where does God want to open up your heart today? Where does God want to open up your heart? Where have you disqualified yourself? Where have you decided it's over and given up? The irony of this story is that as Peter was giving up, the true reality was that Jesus was getting started. In that circumstance where you're giving up, maybe Jesus is just getting going. In that prayer that remains unanswered, maybe Jesus is just getting things moving. Where you think things are coming to an end, maybe with Jesus the whole thing is just getting underway. Jesus doesn't say, "What have you done?" Jesus doesn't say, or point out what a mess we've made of things. He just says, "Do you love me? Do you love me?" And the truth is, probably for all of us here, there's a part of our hearts that truly love him. But it's the bit of our hearts that we've held back that gets in the way. Open the eyes of my heart, Lord.